Let's start with a little introduction of domain. And in fact, it's better if that comes directly from Jean-Marie, who I probably first met in the early years of this century. But Jean-Marie, you'd already been up and running for a while before then. So tell us a little bit about how you got to be where you are today.
I started my journey while I still was at the wine school in 1988 by doing my internship with Henri Jaillet. So I did the 88 with Henri and Emmanuel Rouget. Then I did the vintage 89, 90, 91, and 92 with my father. But a young lion with an older lion was not easy to work together. So I decided to go and improve a bit of my English by working in Oregon in 1993 and work with Domaine Drouin, with Véronique Drouin in 1993. And I think it was around March, April 94, my dad called me back one day while I was still in Oregon and said, if you come back, the winery is yours, except the tractors, they remain mine. So I came back in 1994.
You did play with the tractor,
no? Until last year, actually. I had to, at the age of 80, to stop him driving the tractor last year. He was not very pleased about that. And started my journey as the winemaker of Domaine Fourier in 1994. Definitely not the easiest vintage to start with, but full of learning. Of course, Burgundy was very, very different back then. It was a very different era, but always with the passion of making wine with one main philosophy. A very simple one. I don't know if I'm going to sell my wine, and if I don't sell them, I have to drink them. So drinkability for me was always a very important key factor in my way of winemaking. So, of course, first things that I did when I took over the domain, no blame on my dad for this, because that's what reflected a lot of places of Burgundy, but stopping herbicides, working with natural yeast. I never used more than 20% New York ever. Punching the cap by hand exclusively, no pumping over. Nothing has changed 30 years later.
So you learned a lot, obviously, from Henri Jaillet, but he would have used a lot more New Oak than you use. Would he not?
Yeah, Henri was using 100% New Oak from 1985. Before 85, he was not 100% New Oak. But what I've really learned from Henri and his wife, because not many people often speak about Marcel, who was a wonderful lady, was the precision in the vineyards. They worked solid 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. in the vineyards. But what was really standing out for me with Henri, everything had an explanation. Everything had a reason to be or not to be. So whatever your choices are from vineyards to winemaking, and every actions or inactions from vineyards, how will it impact and result in the final result in the glass? And letting the terroir speaking the truth and not empowering the terroir. So I think that's definitely one of the things I've really learned from Henri, being the less interventionist in order to express the most the identity of each places.
So it's actually one of the things which interests me, and I was just reading my notes, which are in the book, and I was going to ask you about the punching down, because I thought maybe that could have changed, because almost everybody else now tells me that they don't punch down. And I think that maybe they're missing something by not doing it. So do you think it's still a key?
I think the relationship with the grapes is fairly unique when you're punching down. I mean, wine has been made for 6,000 years. Pump over became very popular mid-50s, early 60s, when you was able to afford to buy a pump in Burgundy. But the opposite of pump over, when you are punching the cap, you're working with all your senses awakened. You can feel the heat. You can feel how thick and hard is the cap with the yeast.
You can stand it.
Yes, at some stage of the fermentation, you can even stand on the tanks to realize how strong the life in the tanks is. But for me, I always love punching the cap because I feel connected with each tank when I do it. Pumping over, I don't feel connected when the wine is being pumped. So it impacts my decisions on the frequency and on the stage of the fermentation. Should I punch more or less the cap, depending on what the growing season has been also? What is the ripeness of the fruits and the potential of the extractibility of those grapes, depending on the summer we had. This is something I adjust by the way I feel in terms of relationship with the tank during the fermentation. And when we come to around 90% of the end of the fermentation, then I start to take a glass to taste the results and make my decision, should I punch a little bit more or start to slow down? Well, what is my relationship with the matière? But I don't feel as connected with pump over personally. So that's why I've always worked that way over the decades.
Okay. And the other thing which we haven't yet touched on, but is always a subject to discuss nowadays, is stems. And we know you de-stem 100%, but sometimes you add some stems back in. So I wondered about your thoughts on that subject.
Yeah, in 1995, when I was looking for my identity and giving a new dynamic of the image of Domaine Fourier, 94 was not the easiest vintage for me to work. So I decided to keep 30% of all bunches in 1995. So I tried very early on. And maybe looking back, I tried with the wrong vintage. That's a possibility also. But I thought the tannins was too square. And it was not well integrated into the wine. So for many, many years, many people heard me to say, never again, it's not for me. I have great friends doing great jobs because they feel comfortable with it. I think sometimes it's a bit like the choice of some clothes. There is some clothes you think, it doesn't suit me, but it suits really well someone else. For many, many years, I never wanted to use old bunches until the last few years with the climate change, we are entering into a level where the phenolic maturity sort of become excessive. So, of course, there is the school of picking earlier and earlier and earlier, but the answer is not about keep picking earlier and earlier and earlier year after year. Of course, we've been wondering many questions in the vineyards, increasing the foliage to give more shadow to the fruits, touching less the fruits in summer. But for me, re-adding in vintages, I think like 2019, 2020, I did 22 and 23, but I didn't do in 21. The stems will absorb, a bit like a sponge, the excess of phenolic maturity. So some of the tannins and components will be retained by the stems. And I think it's bringing a bit more finesse and delicacy to the wines. I haven't built my image based on all bunches, so I still want to use it at very small doses. I think if I go above 30%, it changes the style of wine to a different signature of what is Domaine Fourier today. And that's why I'm very cautious and careful to adapt myself to the challenges of global warming, and stems can be a key element to play a little bit with it. But a part of the reason why I don't want to move to too much stems or old bunches is because I looked at the most respected wineries of Burgundy. They are respected for their ability of being consistent over the decades, and not because they're changing the style of winemaking from decades after decades. So for me, I think Domaine Fourier always have been considered, or for me, the purity, the complexity and balance. And I just keep readjusting myself in what is the climate today, but without changing the DNA of Domaine Fourier.
Okay, and I think maybe we should start looking at the actual vineyards. So tonight's tasting is just vineyards in Gevrey-Chambertin, most of what you have. So first up being served is a Gevrey-Chambertin Champeaux 2016. There will be a Cherbaud 2010, a Goulot 16, Combe Moine is 2010. We have, I think, Clos Saint-Jacques in both 2020 and 2010. And also there'll be a Griot Chambertin in 2015. So those are all the younger wines. So maybe you could give your thoughts on the vineyard, starting with Champeaux and then Cherbaud.
Yeah, Champeaux is one of our smallest vineyards in the north of Gevrey-Chambertin. The vineyard was planted in 1919. What's really interesting between, I think there will be some Goulot, I think, also. So in the Gevrey-Chambertin Premier Cru Champeaux, les Goulots and Combe Moine are three plots of lands which are 50 meters from each other. So when I took over the winery, my father used to blend Goulot, Champeaux, and Cherbaud all together to make Gevrey-Chambertin Premier Cru with no name of UD. So the first things I did, 94, I didn't have enough wine, but in 95 was the very first year, just by personal curiosity, that I decided to split the blend and to discover, just for my own curiosity, each of those premier cru, and under the fact that those vineyards only have a distance of 50 meters from each other. So for me, it was a very educational journey about the vineyards of Domaine Fourier and how much terroir can give such different definitions and being so close from each other. And Champeaux is much more red soil, much more iron into it, which always gives a much darker red fruit. It was, for me, one of the first terroirs I understood the most easily. It was delivering this generosity straight away, vintages after vintages. I've always been a big lover of Champeaux, because the combination of vineyards were over 100 years old now, so the size of berries are very, very tiny. And with this red iron soil, gives this dark red fruit and crunchy fruit that I really like, which is very different when I move to the vineyards 50 meters a bit higher. And in terms of the elevation, we speak about 30 meters difference, which is Les Goulots, because Champeaux is a premier cru that several well-known wineries of Gevrey are mastering really well. While Les Goulots, we are not many domains producing it. We're only three domains. And it's one of the northern and highest elevations of Burgundy. Les Goulots has more or less the same story than Croparentoux of Henri. It was not worth it to be planted as vineyards until mid-50s, when Burgundy was not making any money. Planting vineyards there, it was too rocky, but also the grapes was not ripening very well. I always remember my grandma telling me, just above Goulot on Combo One, it used to be planted, and the vineyard was pulled out in 45. It used to be Chardonnay planted up there, because the reds was never ripening. But Les Goulots, my mom and dad still tell me the stories, and they had to burst dynamite there in order to plant it as vineyards. And it has taken at least 9 to 10 years before delivering the first fruits. So much it was hard for the vines to develop a root system there and starting to give the first berries. So it's a wine which is a little bit more strict, a bit more tight. But today, with the climate change, Goulot becomes the new outsider. It's a very cool climate. It's much higher. First vineyard in the shadow in the afternoon. So it is one of those premier cru of Gevrey which keeps the minerality. And minerality is the signature which disappears of Burgundy with global warming. And the fact that this vineyard is in the shadow by 4 p.m., it's already dropping the temperature much earlier and it's much cooler. So it's a wine which, to me, reminds me a bit of the old style of Burgundy with the finesse and delicacy. And Combo One, which stands between the two vineyards of Champeaux and Goulot, is a bit the combination of both sides. That's probably the most complex wine, Combo One, because it definitely has the small size of the fruit. It's an older vineyard planted in 1928. Very, very small berries, but with the coolness of the climate. But it's surrounded by an amphitheater of rock, which used to be a quarry where the rock was extracted to build the castle of Gevrey many centuries ago. And the amphitheater of rock tend to concentrate the heat inside of it. So depending on vintage, if it's a very warm or cooler summer, Combo One could reveal some vintage more minerality character. And when it's much warmer summer, it can reveal much darker red fruit.
It's very unique. Only you have the amphitheater.
We are the only one.
Other plots of Combo One have, it's a very different kind of terroir.
And then if we move a bit more to the famous Clos Saint-Jacques, Clos Saint-Jacques, for us, was with the great uncle of my dad, who was loved hunting, and he was a very close friend with Armand Rousseau. They used to enjoy hunting together on top of the slope of Gevrey. And when the Clos Saint-Jacques came on the market for sale on the auction, the two friends walked together to the vineyards the day of the auction, and the day of the auction was split in a way that it was how many rows do you want to buy? And one row of the Clos Saint-Jacques is 400 meters long, and as our local scale is the Ouvray, it's 428 square meters. At the price of the land back then, nobody was fighting for 28 square meters. So that's what has made Clos Saint-Jacques being so unique in its division between the five producers, that everybody have walls going from the step of the hill all the way to the top. But we are more on the southern pounds with Domaine Rousseau. And just below the lane of the small chapel, this is the youngest part of the Clos Saint-Jacques planted in 1955. And why has it been planted in the 1955? Well, it's been planted by the Rousseau family and us. But before 1955, it was not vineyards. It was grass for the rabbits. And why it was grass for rabbits? Because the climate before 1955, it was guaranteed that these low parts of Clos Saint-Jacques would catch frost nearly every year, every spring. So it was not worth it to plant it as vineyards. So that's a bit a part of the story of Clos Saint-Jacques. What's fairly unique is as you walk up Clos Saint-Jacques, it's a mix of four different types of subsoils. It's like a millefeuille of different type of complexity of fruits, and that's what makes it so unique compared to different places. It's this division which has accidentally given the same equal chance for every producers to come across the balance and the mix of those four different types of subsoils.
This is brilliant stuff, Jean-Marie. It's absolutely fascinating and exactly what we want to hear, really, to get a feel for it. There'll still also be the Griotte Chambertin to talk about. Unfortunately, I have a time problem because I'm halfway back between Porto and Burgundy and just stopped off in Bordeaux en route, but we have to continue on our way. I'll ask somebody maybe from the room if can communicate back to you, just so you can have a little backwards and forwards about how the wines are showing today and if they have any questions about any of the wines. And then if I may, I'm going to need to leave you, and if you could continue on with the team in Hong Kong, that would be great.
Just no problem.
Okay. So do you want just to say a little bit about the Griotte, and then I'll finish the Clos Saint-Jacques with Griotte, and then maybe somebody from the room can open up with any questions or views on the wine. But with great regret, I'm afraid I have to leave you. But thank you all for being there, and a special thanks to you, Jean-Marie.
So, no problem. Thanks, Jasper.
Merci bien. Bye bye.
Yes, so briefly for Griotte, what many people do not realize, Griotte Chambertin is the third smallest Grand Cru of all Burgundy. After La Romanée-Conti, Griotte is only 2.6 hectares. The origin of the name of Griotte is coming from chalk. And several places of Burgundy are referred to chalky soil, like Les Cras in Chambolle-Musigny from Christophe Fournier, or Criot-Bâtard-Montrachet. Criot is the same origin of name. And Griotte, it's also a type of subsoil which is much more chalky. So Griotte is not a Grand Cru of power, it's a Grand Cru of depth. I always describe Griotte being the Musigny of Gevrey. The Chambertin has the power, has the shoulder, and Griotte has the purity and the depth of its terroir. And that's what makes Griotte very different from the range of the other Grand Cru. It never was originally the most famous Grand Cru of Burgundy before global warming, but its ability to keep finesse with the climate change of today, it's definitely one of the Grand Cru who keep this beautiful balance with its acidity. And that's what makes Griot quite interesting. Our total production is between 4 and 5 barrels. So it's very limited. It's our also one of our smallest production. So if you have any questions, please feel free.
No, thank you so much for the presentation. I think it's been exceptional detail. We've been comparing the wines, and obviously we have a range of vintages in front of us. One thing that has stood out as particularly is the crystalline purity, but the detail on the 16 vintage. Would love to get your further thoughts on that, especially because we've been comparing them versus, you know, 2020, 2010, which are also lovely vintages in their own right. And we have a 2015 Griot in front of us as well. But they're all very different in character. But I think one of the comments that I heard in the room was the 16 is particularly exciting. But we'd love to get your views and thoughts on the vintage differences as well that you've experienced.
Yeah, I think it's a vintage that we don't speak very often about, 2016, because it was in the shadow of 2015. I sort of see a bit of similarity of what's the reputation of 2016, like what was the reputation of 2010 after 2009. And one of the main things I find in similarity, in common, 2010 and 2016, is how cold was Burgundy in August. It was really, really cold. The mornings was around 10 degrees, and it keeps the natural acidity of the fruit present. And which is breathing through and standing out through the glass of wine. What is interesting to understand is in the past, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, the definition of a great vintage was a vintage when the weather was beautiful and really hot in summer for Burgundy. But every plant on earth, except the cactus, stop the photosynthesis above 32 degrees Celsius. So each time the vines are exposed above 32 degrees Celsius, the vines will start consuming the natural acidity of the fruits. And it depends if we speak about summer, as the exposure above 32 degrees Celsius been between 2 p.m. to 4 p.m., or has it been from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m., the more the vines are exposed above 32 degrees, and the more we lose natural acidity, and the more we will lose the freshness of the vintage. And 2016 and 2010, basically, was vintages that we never went above 32 degrees Celsius. So the vines never had to consume or burst the natural acidity retained in the fruit, which is standing out in the glass through the freshness. It's wines with great pH, good acidity, good balance, but with sunny days, it was sunny and cold, which means the light was still giving the photosynthesis and gave a good phenolic maturity, but with good acidity. Some other vintages, like 2015 or 2020, are vintages that the weather is beautiful, it's nice, it's sunny, but the temperature goes above 32 degrees. And then we start to lose the natural acidity retained in the vines. And that's when we lose a little bit of freshness. And there's nothing much we can do about it. It's the answer is not always by picking earlier and earlier, because
you still need the maturity.
You still need a minimum of phenolic maturity to reveal the terroir and the identity of a location. So that's why we are keep readjusting ourselves to the farming practice according to the climate change.
A nice thing to have to choose something. So, but if you compare 15 and 16 in terms of overall, would you prefer the 15 or the 16?
I think they will have a different time frame of drinkability. I think we love the 16. That reminds me also like 2010, same thing. Because of this acidity that makes them so delicious, so young, that we tend to drink them very quickly. But they also still have a beautiful ability to age. 2015, it's much more of a structure of the tannins, which you might want to keep them a bit longer. But I personally like the 2016 more in spring, summer time, when the weather is quite warm outside. I prefer a wine which has better freshness and acidity. And a vintage like 2015, for me, is more a wine for winter. But there are window of ability to age for me. They have the same potential, but their curve of aging is a bit different.
Maybe one more question for me is the recent hot vintages of, we've had 18, 19, 20, I guess 21 is an exception, but 22 and 23, how are you finding those? And obviously those are in stark contrast to the past. How do you find those in terms of approachability, drinkability? I mean, a bunch of us here have those wines in our cellars. So what should we be doing with them?
I think it's important to realize that many people are wondering lots of questions in Burgundy today to preserve the freshness. For us, it's really, I wouldn't say a challenge, but I remember, for example, 2005, which was the, it's not, sorry, not 2005, 2003, which was really a real shock for us. How do we manage a vintage with so much heat? And we didn't have much experience about how to manage this type of vintage. What for me has been happening for the last 5 or 6 years is we have gained experiences and we have readapted ourselves with a taller canopy, wider canopy, more foliage. But there have been a lot of questions about winemaking. But and I'm sure you've seen in between the work of Jasper and other people, lots of producers in Burgundy are considering other types of vessels for aging their wines. So, of course, one of the most common that people have heard or seen is amphora. And I think there are some people who have jumped at small doses. Some of the producers have 100% amphora today. I think there's lots of questions being considered at the moment, and the answer is not just being extremist in one component or another. Today at the domain, I've been experimenting amphora, and I do have also a few stainless steel barrels, which have the size of the casks, because I can drive some élevage with zero sulfite, despite the fact that the ripeness we get today, the level of acidity being not so good, we are more open to bacterial attack. So there can be more problem of Brettanomyces, for example. And when we speak global warming, it's not just about vineyards. You just need to imagine that the speed of growth of trees is much faster. So the oak for barrels is also a quality which is declining very fast. And aging in new oak in the window of the next 20 years becomes more and more risky because there's much more breathing exchange with a new barrel, which will only bring you to one answer, is adding more sulfides into the wines. So I think still today, everybody is adjusting to his level. And for me, a play of maybe 10 or 20% of the final blending in alternative type of vessels than oak, I still give a priority to barrels. But due to the variation of yields from 1 year to another, and I do not want to have one vintage, for example, 22 after 21, I don't want to have one vintage more oaky than another one. And that was a problem of logistics of barrels. So being able to have alternative type of vessels, like a bit of amphora or a bit of stainless steel barrels, is something I can store empty 1 year or 2 years and reuse it when I need it. You know, mathematically speaking, I'm not going to enter about talking about prices of Burgundy, but I definitely think that everything has gone far too high. But a new barrel today is not, in France is 900 euros plus tax. So if you divide by 300 bottles, somebody would use 100% oak, it's 30 euros per bottle, just to add oak flavor into the wine. So, but above all of this, for me, terroir is the land, is the soil, and how can we express the integrity of a soil definition through a grape variety into a glass without modifying this expression down the road by a different source of contamination. And for me, for Domaine Fourier, I keep also my same principles, is balancing the use of sulfites. I am sensitive to headaches. I want to still measure the quantity of sulfites I'm using and a balance between different type of vessels to keep freshness in the wines and allowing me to work with a low sulfite like I always had for the last 30 years is very important to me.
Understood. Maybe we can leave you with one last question that we ask all producers that join this. And I like it, the fact that David is sitting right next to you, so he can already work on the financing for you. If there's one vineyard that you could own, anyone in Burgundy, which would it be?
Oh, yeah, well, I think the ultimate dream is Musigny for me.
Yeah.
Musigny. That is surprisingly an increasingly common answer that we get from a lot of producers. But we have faith in David's ability to help you source that. So thank you so much, Jean-Marie, for all the insights today. This was fantastic. It helps us a lot to appreciate the wines. We're also very excited to try some of the 78s and 79s that we've got to come. I know they're made from not yourself, but your prior generation. So we're very excited to try those as well.
Thank you so much, but wishing you all a great evening and thank you very much for your support.
Thank you, Jean-Marie. Thank you. See you.
Bye-bye.